Welcome to the Barbara Schulte Show with host Barbara Schulte and producer Ben Self. The Barbara Schulte Show brings conversations, stories, and tips intended to power up a writer's potential for more success, fun, and the confidence to write and live with grace, courage, and the grit to never give up.
Hey, it's Barb, and welcome to my podcast. Now, I can't tell you how excited I am to be doing this. I've wanted to start a podcast for a while, and finally the stars lined up, and here we are. And I'll be interviewing some of my favorite people in the horse world who I know will inspire you. And I'll be doing some episodes solo too, which I'm really looking forward to. Now today, I'm going to do two things. First, I take you on a little journey about my life that explains how I got to this moment in time. And then I tell you about seven things I believe people really misunderstand about quote unquote mental skills. And then I share my take on them. First, let's go to Southern Illinois. And in a tiny town across the river from St. Louis, and about 4 miles outside of that tiny town, and you would pull in to my parents' place. And it was about 100 acres or so, and the big driveway in front of the barn was probably about 75 feet wide, and you'd look on the left, and there's this huge old barn with 100 stalls, wooden stalls. And then on the right, when I was in like seventh or eighth grade, there was a, you know, old house. But attached to the 100-stall barn was a tiny indoor arena. And then attached to that was a place called Cutton, which was what was written on the gate. Cutton, Hoss, they spelled it H-O-S-S, Alley, and there were 20 stalls there. And that's because my dad so loved cutting horses. He grew up originally as a mule trader and then just kept taking in problem horses and just grew this incredible business of buying and selling and trading horses. We never did any breeding of horses. We did show, but it was a marketing thing. We never went for titles or anything like that. So anyway, let's go back to the parking lot, and the house was on the right, and then you would go down this little walkway, and then there was this other old building, and then in the front of the building, there was always a saddle maker in there. One of the saddle makers was Price McLaughlin, another one was Benny Veach a little bit later, and then behind that little building, there was a yearling pen, and just all over this 100 acres, there would be pastures and pastures of horses, anywhere from maybe 20 to 50 horses in a pasture, mares, geldings, registered, unregistered, yearlings. We had quite a cast of characters as I was growing up. We had one person who only doctored horses. He doctored and clipped. That's all he did. His name was Irie. And then we had this guy that was about 6'8", bigger than life. He was the mechanic. His name was Otmer, and we called him Beetlebum all the time. And then there was Elmer, who did nothing but feed. He would start feeding the horses in the morning, fed them, would go to the mill. Dad made his own feed. He ground whatever, the corn. I'm not sure exactly now what all they did. Just in time to start feeding again for the afternoon. Elmer was quiet, and he was always kind of spying on what was going on and caught Gail Veach and I buying cigarettes from the cigarette machine and jumping on hot rod and smoking cigarettes as we loped through the pastures, you know, beyond all the main buildings. But, you know, it was interesting because Dad had this idea, and it was a good one, because it worked in the business, that the five of us children, we would ride the higher end horses, and then we would take them to shows. And that was, the idea was to not come back with any horses in the trailer. And one thing about coming to our place, because of all these pastures of horses, if you came for a reining horse, you came for a cutting horse, you came for a pleasure horse, you came for a jumping horse, you came to buy a baby, you had about 20 horses to look at. And my dad was very, very charismatic. And, you know, it was almost like you just couldn't leave Cletus Hullings without putting a horse in your trailer. But the unique thing is you could always bring it back if it didn't work out for you, and you could go through 20 horses again. So I had no place in the world where you can go buy a horse, take it home, bring it back, trade it in. And Dad was something, and he would have a waiting room full of people just waiting to talk to him because of his personality. He also would come to Texas and come to the Four Sixes Ranch, come to the King Ranch, and buy tractor trailer full of horses. And when he brought those horses home, people from all around the area would know that one of these trucks was coming home. So they would be lined up waiting for the horses to be unloaded, and Dad would be in this trap with a, you know, like a whip just to make sound and go in and by, and then the ranch hands, we didn't ride those horses coming off the truck, but the ranch hands would ride the horses, and people would buy them. You know, like the horses would get off the trailer and people would load them into their trailer. So it really was an incredibly unique situation. Besides the cast of characters of employees, we had quite the famous people who came through. Again, Dad loved cutting horses, so there was Keith Barnett, and there was J.T. Fisher, and Shorty Freeman. And so as a young girl, I got to see some of the most famous cutting horses, the foundation horses like Alice Starr and Vegas Boy. So that was exciting. And then plus the customers who came, because we were in Southern Illinois. People from Canada came, people from Texas came, the East Coast, not so much California, but, you know, from Colorado and that area. So because Dad was very proud of his family, and because we had this incredible work ethic that we, you know, after school all year round, we had 3, 4, 5 horses to ride. And in the summer, we had a much bigger string, and it really wasn't an option if we rode or not. That was our family business. When we went to shows, Dad really expected us to do well. And I think that because he expected us to do well, we did well. So that was a good thing. The other thing is that we didn't get particularly close to a lot of horses because, you know, they were there, and they were there to be bought and sold, and that was our job. I can remember one time I went to a show, though, and there was a new horse, and I went in the cutting pen, put my hand down, and this horse just ran out towards the turnback man and ran back and jammed my leg into the herd. And I put my arms around this horse, walking back and crying, asking why he did that to me. But overall, we couldn't really develop those close relationships with the horses because they wouldn't be there very long. And then the other thing is that Dad always said that because we were Hullings, that we had more time in the saddle and that we should be expected to be beyond other people. Not that he was looking down on other people, but just because of his standards. And I think one of the things of that, at least I internalized it, as, you know, wondering, kind of comparing myself to other people. So that's a quick thumbnail of what it was like, you know, through my high school years. One thing that's great is that Sonny Rice worked for us for quite a while. And I can remember Boyd Rice and Matlock Rice in this little fence that was connected to that 100-year-old house. And I just remember those guys as little tykes. So let's fast forward to college. And I actually got a little bit burned out because I really like variety. I've always done that and liked that in my life, for better or for worse. And so I decided I was going to become a speech pathologist and audiologist. So I got a master's degree in speech pathology and audiology. And during that time, I met my husband, and I was doing an internship in Arizona staying at my sister, Tootie, who was then married to Tom Lyons of The Cutting World. And my husband, while I was at school, would go out to the Round Pen, and he'd say, "Hey, can you do this? This looks like so much fun. I would really like to do this." So I said, "Oh, yeah, you know, I grew up doing that. I know how to do that." So we kind of, you know, left that there. We moved to Washington State because that's where we both had jobs. And somehow, and I'm not sure about this part, but I was offered a job as a trainer at Harlan Radomski's in Washington State. And that started out my cutting training career. Not too long after that, I got pregnant. Being a pregnant horse trainer was not really the ideal situation to be. It was not, I don't think, everyone's dream as an owner. So Tom and I switched and we moved to Texas, and I immediately started loving to teach people. And so I had a simultaneous business of training cutting horses and age defend horses, and love coaching people. About 4 or 5 years into my career, I was watching competitions in Fort Worth, and I'll never forget watching Greg Welsh. And you know, he was riding this little black horse. It was, you know, a fine little horse, but this horse was not at the top of the heat of the athletes of the horses. And I was thinking, you know, wonder why Greg and a few of these other people are always winning and in the finals, and they're obviously not always riding the best horses. And so I was really curious about that, and I'd always liked psychology. And so my sister Tootie introduced me to Dr. Jim Lehrer, who was then, it was then called LGE Sports Science in Orlando, Florida, where they train Olympic and professional athletes. And so I went to Florida and hit it off with Dr. Lehrer, fell in love with the training. He asked me to be a certified performance coach in the horse world. What was really funny is that he was a guy, he was a tennis guy, and he was, you know, he sat me down and he goes, "Okay, Barb, now tell me about this horse world." And for some reason I said, "We know there's English," and I described the saddle and started talking about jumping. And then I have no idea why I chose this, but I just did. It was just, you know, what came to my mind. Then there's a Western saddle, it's much different. And then there, I wanted to explain to him about barrel racing. So he looks at me and he goes, "Well, Barb, how many barrel jumpers do you think there are?" So that became the joke with Dr. Lehrer, that about how many barrel jumpers there were in the horse world. And he asked me during that first visit if I would want to be trained as a certified performance coach, because he wanted to try having specific trainers in baseball and football and, you know, different sports. So that began my journey into personal performance. And I have to tell you that there are a few life events that I've had that completely changed the direction of my life. And that is absolutely one of them. I fell in love with the training because it made so much sense to me. It was all based on the ability to call up positive emotion and focus and calmness and the tools to do that. And how to present yourself under pressure when it mattered, because that was what his research had done, was to research how the highest performers of Olympic and professional athletes knew how to perform under pressure. And he had all of this research that he had done and synthesized it into a very clear way to apply the tools. Well, it changed everything. I came home, and within 2 or 3 years, won 2 major events, you know, won the Augusta Futurity, won a big event on the Pacific Coast. And, you know, I just couldn't get enough of it. And really, because it is all about cultivating our potential and what's within us, which is always unlimited, I just kept studying and kept applying, and also began to, you know, read, of course, and study other people. And it just intrigues me, because it's thrilling to me to think about, you know, how can we be our best? And I applied the principles directly to the horses. So then another thing happened. About 5 or 6 years after that, our son Zane, who was 16, passed away from bone cancer. And that is the next really big life-changing event that I had. Because not only because of the trauma in my life, but because I realized with his passing what was really important to me. And I made a vow that I would always train and live by my own values of what I thought was important. And the other thing that happened is that I, through that time, through that intense time of grieving, I applied the principles that I had learned in the high performance training to my life. And those principles were a lifeline to me. And all of a sudden I started thinking, you know, this isn't just for writing and showing. This is really for living. And so I'm very grateful to that. And then a third thing happened. For the first time in my life, because as a young girl, you know, the horses came and went through the barn. And as a professional cutting horse trainer, I trained a horse to perform, and you know, the scorecard is how you do in the arena. And of course, if an owner is happy with how you do. But I, for the first time ever, because of how I was feeling, I went out and I just wanted to be with the horses. I just wanted to put my arms around a horse's neck. And I know in that time that I realized this whole aspect of horses and why people are with horses and how horses help healing and what joy they bring to our lives just for being a horse. And I hadn't experienced that until that time. So those three things of living by my values and understanding the powerful impact of horses just for their own sake, and also that there was another whole dimension to all of the information that I had learned at LGE, that also marked another time and trajectory of my life. What I did through I started this personal performance journey in probably 1995, 1996, and then Zane passed in 2000. And then I remained a professional trainer until about 2016. And then in true form, because I love to do different things, you know, it just excites me. You know, I wanted just to take the chapter of my life and just roll with still teaching cutting and cow skills, because I absolutely love that, and getting the word about these performer skills out to the world, because they are the information is something that is not taught in school. It's something that most people don't even know exists, and it's life-changing, it's fun, and I just decided that I wanted to be with horses and learn about them in ways that I had never had at home or as a trainer. And so that's what I've been doing since 2016, and I've had the good fortune to collaborate with people. With Sandy Collier, I've learned not all about, but the rain cow horse world has been really fun, and to do clinics with her, and she does the reining and the boxing and down the fence part, and I do the herd work and the mental skills part, and she does the showing part. So that's been a blast. And then I also do retreats with Julie Goodnight, and that's just pure horsemanship and in the mountains, and that's really fun. And then I do some, you know, just cow clinics with Shannon Piggott in Texas. So this diversity of people and having fun and continuing to learn, that's what is so amazing to me. I mean, there is so much to learn. So that's where I've come from, and that's where I am now. And I'm really excited to do this podcast, because I think that we'll all continue to learn from the people that we interview. And from time to time, I'll share tools and strategies that I know it makes such a huge difference. But for now, I'm going to get to the second part of what I want to do in this podcast and share with you some what I see as common myths about how people perceive mental skills. The first thing that I want to say is that I don't think there's a good word or a good couple words or phrase that describe quote unquote mental skills. That's the word I use a lot, or I use performer skills. That's also something that people don't really relate to. But here's why I say that about the word mental skills. It is an internal state of calmness and focus and belief in yourself. But it's not just that. It's also physiological. So for example, it is an ability to call up this calmness and focus, and it is what allows you to be your best, because of the mind, body, and our emotions are all one. Like, you can't separate them. You can't think, oh, you know, I'm not going to do well today, without that making your body tight. And so, as you know, one of the aspects and the skill to be learned is to learn how to get into a certain mental and emotional state, because it facilitates what you need to do with your body. And that's the essence of the performer skills that I learned at LGE, which became the Human Performance Institute, but it's not the only thing. Another big part of it is just a basic belief in ourselves. And I call this the part that when you wake up in the middle of the night, and if you really think if you can do it or not, and you know what really worries you, and if you have clarity about your purpose and about your values, and that's something that lies like below the surface, but has so much to do with our vision of ourselves and what we think we can do, and you know, if we can do it. And that too, for most of us, has to be cultivated. And then the third part is our ability to not be concerned about what other people think, and really on the flip side of that, to have surround ourselves with positive people and trainers who believe in us and friends who support us and knowing that because the number one thing in our lives is this feeling of connection with other people, which is, by the way, why we love horses so much, is because we can be ourselves. So that's a big thing too. So it's really these, our belief in ourselves, our ability to perform under pressure, which are the performer skills, which is how you think and what you do with your body, which are so trainable. And then it's this whole finding ease with the people in our lives and feeling comfortable to show, for example, around other people. So all of those things, to me, fall under the category of quote-unquote mental skills. It's really what's going on the inside of us that causes us to invest our energy in a way that takes us to the place where we want to go. The second thing is that when I think about or used to think about these people that were just so good, you know, like just cool as cucumbers, cookies in the herd, always made good cuts. Buster Welch was one of them. Just you think of a trainer or you think of a person that you love to watch and is so cool under pressure. Sometimes we think that those people were born that way. But one of the most compelling things that I learned was that it's not just a talent. You might have a certain amount of physical talent, but the ability to think clearly and the ability to plan what you're going to do in the arena and to stay focused and to stay calm, that's a skill. That's not a talent. So we don't have to limit ourselves to thinking, oh, we'll always be a certain way. Do we need to work on the technical skills? Yes, from the best of the best. But anyone can aspire to reach whatever they want to do. The next thing is that, and this one is a hard one, and it's like, is that setbacks are like putting the richest lessons of life and riding that on steroids for our benefit if we choose to see it that way. And sometimes we can look back on things in our lives that were so hard or disappointments, or we deem them as failures. And when we look back, those are really the things that projected us forward. And I can remember so many times, you know, driving home from Will Rogers, crying in the truck all the way home, you know, missing the finals by half a point. But knowing that, you know, as soon as I got settled down, that I would look back, watch my videos, and see what it was, you know, that I needed to fix next. And then I think this fourth point is a really important one, because I think especially if, you know, we can't ride for years, say we get hurt, or as we get older and we can't, you know, like there's a period of time in riding, even though we can ride the rest of our life, but there's a period of time of athleticism. But it's more important about who we are becoming as a person than what we win or who we impress. And I was telling you about Dr. Lehrer's research about initially it's all about the performer skills and how you think and what you do with your body and how you breathe, and all of those things are really important. But what he found over time, that the most consistent performers and the happiest performers were the ones who had a purpose beyond just winning in the arena. And I think that was one of the things with my situation with Zane that really changed everything for me. The next is that change is always inevitable, and it takes a lot of courage to go with it. You know, we always, all of us really like to have the ground underneath our feet be stable. We think that, you know, this is how it will always be. And the reality is clients change, horses change. Again, we get older, or, you know, a spouse passes, or, you know, something happens and everything changes. Things can change in a heartbeat. And it really takes courage to lean into the change and to go with it. And it's a bit like the setback that you find the gift in it. The next thing, and this one is a hard one, I think, is to not compare ourselves to other people. When I do surveys with, and I ask the people on our website, you know, what is it that is the hardest for you? It is always, number one, is the fear of what other people think, what a trainer that used to have a horse will think. My friends don't think I ride well enough. Just all of those, oh, that person is here, so I, you know, there's no way that I'm going to be able to win, you know, at this show. And Dr. Lehr, in one of our early sessions, said, if you are thinking about how you compare yourself to another person, you might as well shoot yourself in the foot, because your job is to focus on getting yourself ready, getting your horse ready, and going into the arena and doing your job. And that's all that you ever really have control over. So that comparison to others, and finding our, navigating our way through that and recognizing those thoughts and letting them go and replacing them, is really a big part of the challenge for all of us. And then this is the last one, and it's not that these seven are the only ones, but I think that they're ones that people often get confused. But you hear that, oh, I'm either competitive or I'm not competitive. And I think that there is definitely an aspect of temperament that we are have this, like, kind of competitive gene that we really like to go and go for it. But, you know, I loved to show, especially loved to show after I learned all of the performer skills and practiced them, because, not because I wanted that outer recognition. I mean, sure, who doesn't love that when you do well? But getting into this place of focus and calmness is, this might sound a little corny, is such a high, and by high, I mean it's just such a high positive state of emotion, and it feels so good, and you are one with your horse, you're one with your job, you feel like, open the gate, let's go. It's like, kind of give me the ball if you were playing basketball. And the fact that that can be trained, and the fact that it has such an impact on your riding, that is what I craved. And that was why I like to show and like to explore that, and also just get better and better in my performance. And also the fact that when you compete, you have to put yourself on the line. You know, you can't like say, well, I'll just do this tomorrow. If you sign up to show in the futurity, you sign up to show, and they're going to call your name. So competition means many different things to many people. For some people, it's social, and they love to be with their horse. They love to learn. And I just think that that's an interesting thing to me. So it's not that you're competitive or you're not competitive. I think it means, or I know it means different things to different people. So in this podcast, I hope to help you with a couple of things. One is to help you love looking on the inside and be inspired to be courageous and be yourself, which is where your joy is. I want to help you with learning the performer skills that we never have learned unless we have some training in them and are aware of them, and then also practice them. You know, it's interesting to me that Dr. Lehrer, he told this story one time that there was a tennis player that had all this incredible talent, and she was 50th in the world, and she came there for training, and she, you know, like loved the training, and within a few months, like rose to number one in the world. I mean, it was just this, it was how she could transform her emotions to positive emotion and how she thought about things, what she did with her body. Well, she thought that she had it and that she didn't need it anymore. So she stopped coming, she stopped training, she stopped so consciously applying it to her game. And she dropped like to 25th in the world in a short time. So the tools and the things that we'll explore here and also with other people, which is going to be so much fun to learn from them as well, those are things that, because they're skills, they must be practiced and they must be applied to your own riding. And I hope to help you with that because I really love doing that. And to also give you ease in just the value of the reason that you ride and the purpose for your riding and the enjoyment of your horse, and that that's something that just only you really know. So we're all going to continue to learn, and I'm right there with you. I'm looking forward to visiting with all of our guests, and I hope that you'll send in your topic suggestions and enjoy the speakers, and thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Barbara Schulte Show. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow us on Instagram and like our Facebook page.